This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. On today's program, we talk with Michigan Radio investigative reporter Lindsay Smith. What's up?
I've been looking at Eastern Michigan University's new athletic training center and the not-so-transparent way EMU is paying for it.
We talked to a couple who left Florida for Michigan because of hurricanes, sea level rise, and other climate change effects.
We're leaving because we see this place as somewhere where you don't want to live in 10 years.
Then we hear how farmers are beginning to use drones for crops.
It's one thing to get up and fly a drone. It's an entirely another thing to derive useful information from that drone.
And another vacation season is winding down, but resorts are finding it's tough to staff.
The hospitality industry in particular is really having challenges finding workers.
All of that and more coming up on Stateside. First, let's get a news update. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. As Michigan farmers face uncertainty with changing weather, tariffs, well, new technology in the form of drones is helping provide some predictability. That's later in the show. But first, well, it's Friday. Time for an end-of-the-week check on Lansing with our political commentators. Ken Sikkema is a senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader in the Michigan State Senate. T.J. Buchholz is president of Vanguard Public Affairs, a progressive political strategy firm in Lansing. All right, gentlemen, last week I suggested next time we talk about something other than finding a way to fix the state's roads. And yet here we are about to talk about the latest news about the legislature and the governor and the struggle to find a way to fix the roads. So I guess the latest news is that House Minority Leader Democrat Christine Gregg basically says Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer's proposed 45-cent fuel tax increase is basically dead. Ken Sikkema, any surprises there?
No, I'm not surprised about that. I guess I'm a little surprised that the media thinks that kind of pronouncement is news. I mean, when the governor proposed it late last winter, I think everybody around Lansing and in Lansing suspected that, you know, it's not going to end up happening. It's not going to be 45 cents. And that's why I say I'm not surprised, but I don't think it's particularly newsworthy. I mean,
Well, is that basically her way of throwing out, here's a goal, now find a plan?
I think that's where we're at. We're in the same spot we were in late last winter when she first announced it. If that isn't it, then what is it?
TJ, Representative Gregg says Democrats in the House are working with the Republicans, so everyone is, quote, putting some skin in the game. House Speaker Republican Lee Chatfield says he's optimistic. What's that all mean for the governor?
Ken's right. You know, we're kind of in the same space that we were back in the wintertime. And I think that probably for citizens, that's not necessarily encouraging in terms of having their lawmakers work for them in Lansing. There's a lot of conversations going on behind the scenes. There's a lot of discussion, obviously. But I think the governor, to her credit, put her reputation on the line saying the 45 cents gas tax solves the problem. We could implement this overnight, but this is the magnitude of the problem that we have in front of us. Let's get to that point. I don't ever think it was a all or nothing. I mean, this governor has said sort of publicly, or at least alluded to the fact that she's willing to horse trade and willing to make a deal here to address our problem. But there are some things that are sacrosanct for her. Obviously, I think she's come around more on teacher pensions to say that those won't be touched, or there are things that she will not do. But I do think that the dialogue is still very much alive in Lansing, which is good. I wish they would have got to it sooner than now.
There's 1 month to the deadline to reach a budget agreement. Governor Whitmer responded to the Republican allegation that she's holding the budget hostage. Basically, she said, me? It's not me.
But it's time for the Republican-led legislature to get serious, to get back to work, to stop screwing around, and to get it done.
So who's screwing around here, Ken?
Well, the Republicans, it's not Governor Whitmer who tied roads to the budget issue. Republicans actually did that a few years ago when, for the first time in history, they started using the general fund to help fund roads. So the road discussion or the road issue is intricately tied up with the budget. Neither side can avoid that anymore. You know, it's easy to say what you're against and vote no. It's a lot harder to say what you're for and vote yes. And we simply, both Republicans and Democrats, the legislature and the governor, have got to get to yes on both the budget and fixing the roads.
TJ, clock's ticking. What has to happen?
I think that's the major stumbling block right now. I think that Governor Whitmer is frustrated by the lack of progress. I think that she's frustrated that she has to do her due diligence now and let state departments know and that there could be a potential shutdown, and they have to go through the machination of, you know, shutdown planning at a time where they don't have the necessary resources to commit to it that they want to. I think she's frustrated by Republicans and maybe even the House Minority Leader not being able to be at the table. I think she's felt like she's at the table by herself wanting to make a deal, and no one sort of formally is stepping up to demonstrate that there is some urgency here. And with 30 days before the budget is done, I continue to be concerned that we don't have things on paper. And even if, let's pretend next week they came up with some sort of, you know, deal, it still takes time to draft the bills, to get them through the process. And I do think at the end of the day, we're going to be on pins and needles right until the end, which is what nobody wanted. Certainly the governor didn't want that in the beginning.
TJ Buchholz is president of Vanguard Public Affairs, a progressive political strategy firm in Lansing. Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader in the Michigan State Senate. Gentlemen, have a great Labor Day weekend.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks, Lester.
Eastern Michigan University has a brand spanking new training facility for its student athletes. It's the first major construction project for EMU athletes in 20 years. The catch? The athletic department has not raised enough money to pay for it yet. Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith is here with me now. First of all, how big of a deal is this to have this new facility at Eastern? I mean, what's it actually do for Eastern Michigan University as far as attracting students and faculty or actually making it a better school?
So they call it the Student Athlete Performance Center. It is pretty sweet. It's got new locker rooms, coach's office, players lounge, recruiters lounge, pools. They've got this giant new scoreboard for the football games right on top of it. So the folks in the athletic department are understandably pretty pumped about this. This week, they did a ribbon cutting ceremony for the new building. EMU football coach Chris Creighton says this new training facility is already making a difference, Lester, in recruiting student athletes. He told a huge crowd of athletes and donors about this kid he was recruiting over the summer. And Creighton goes, this recruit sits down inside this new building.
And he goes, I was just down at another school in the MAC, and they got a pretty nice stadium, but he said, I'm an offensive lineman. I don't care about that. He goes, they don't have anything like this. And he didn't like try to make some huge statement. But I'm telling you, I was sitting there, and I'd never once heard that ever in 6 years, ever. And inside, I was like, what did you just say? It's a big deal for all of us, and it's a big deal for the future. It's a big deal for this department, and it's a big deal for all of Eastern Michigan University. Let's celebrate tonight, and let's be proud.
I mean, you can hear it in his voice,
right? He's a little excited there.
But I want to play you another clip. From that same ceremony on Monday, the chair of Eastern's Board of Regents, James Webb.
This is being built completely with donor dollars. We are not taking anything from the general fund.
The problem is that's just not true. Eastern plans to use $8 million from the general fund. $12 million is supposed to come from fundraising, donors. So far, EMU's athletic department has raised only half of that money that it is on the hook for. Eastern officials say the athletic department is committed to raising this money, but there is no deadline to do that.
All right, so how does a public university greenlight a $20 million building without actually having the money to pay for it first?
Well, you know they borrowed it, and it was part of a larger redevelopment and construction project. A number of other buildings are affected, too. But there's been this ongoing friction at Eastern about how much tuition and these like general fund dollars subsidizes Eastern's athletic program. When the board borrowed this money back in 2017, there was this deal to have donors pay for most of this facility because regular students really aren't going to be using this building really at all. And at first, Eastern unveils this even bigger, more expensive plan to upgrade athletics. This was in March of 2017 under a previous athletic director. That's when they announced the largest cash pledge in the school's history, $6 million. To put that in perspective, a $1 million fundraising year for Eastern Athletics is a good year, $1 million. So this donor, $6 million, it turns out was just too good to be true.
Well, why is that? Who was the guy?
Keith Stone. He's an Eastern grad. And the same month that his $6 million pledge was announced by the school, Keith Stone writes EMU's president a pretty frank email that we got under a Freedom of Information Act request. So the same month EMU announces this dude is giving them record cash for a new athletic complex, behind the scenes, he is raising big red flags, warning about backing off this pledge. And in the end, he does back off. He does not give EMU $6 million. So EMU scales down the project in summer 2017, unveils this new vision under a new athletic director. The Board of Regents approves it in December, but it does not disclose at that time that this giant donation is not coming through.
Back up a little bit. So do we know why he decided not to give EMU the money?
Well, one thing is for sure, it's not because he doesn't have the money. From what I can tell, this guy is loaded. And I say that because a year ago, he sold a corporate payment company that he started and owned outright for $600 million. So he's got a killer mansion in Florida. I tried to get a hold of Keith Stone. No luck. But I will say it's clear from the emails that I got through this Freedom of Information request that Mr. Stone was really impressed with the previous athletic director at Eastern. And she left Eastern just 2 weeks after the big cash pledge was announced. It may have been that he was like more comfortable with her and not the new one. We don't really know. I did get a hold of the previous athletic director. She didn't want to talk about this.
So Eastern Michigan University just opens this new athletic facility. Most of the money was supposed to come from fundraising, but they don't have that money in hand yet. What's EMU have to say about all this?
I talked to Eastern spokesman Jeff Larkham. As a rule, he says they just don't talk about donor relationships. It's, you know, a privacy thing. They want to protect these relationships. But he really wants to disconnect these two things, this huge donation that was for athletics that they lost, and this brand new athletic building that's not paid for, because they were different visions under different athletic directors. Here's what he says.
One thing I want to really make clear is that the university at no time misrepresented itself publicly. Okay, that project, the project that was approved in December of 2017, was announced at the region meeting, voted upon, and contained the elements that were in the particular region's action item that day.
What he's saying is, look, that gift we lost was for a vision that was not the vision and project that we have right now. But both visions were for athletics. They were presented in the same year, and EMU didn't mention that they had lost this huge gift until this year, roughly 2 years after they knew that it wasn't coming through. So what I'm saying is, if you've got $6 million, Lester, I know you're in public radio, big money, right?
Yes.
EMU Athletics is looking for donations.
Yeah, well, good luck with that. Lindsay Smith, Michigan Radio's investigative reporter, thanks for the time.
My pleasure.
More to come. Stay tuned. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. For the past three decades, Michigan and other states have been losing population to the Sun Belt, states like Arizona, Texas, and Florida. That's mostly due to jobs and, of course, the promise of sunny weather. But years-long droughts in some places, hurricanes in others, are leading some to reconsider where they call home. That includes Vincent Ayula and Debbie Anderson. The couple moved to Michigan from Felsmere, Florida, 12 miles off the Atlantic coast, this past April. And they join me now. So climate change models predict rising sea levels, more intense hurricanes, and increasingly hot temperatures in areas like Florida. How much did those concerns have to do with your decision to move to the Midwest?
Well, when we first moved to our place in Felsmere, the place that we bought didn't have hurricane shutters, and they were saying, oh, you don't need hurricane shutters. Well, what, 2 years later?
Within the year.
Within the year, two hurricanes hit right where we lived, back to back, within a couple weeks of each other. And we did get hurricane shutters before that, which was nice. But, you know, the fact that they didn't have hurricanes before very often, and now we're seeing more, kind of convinced us that maybe it's time to get out of Florida and move somewhere else.
But you kind of knew that before you went to Florida, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're from the Northeast. She's from the D.C. area. I'm from New York City. I moved to Florida way back when. I just wanted a change. I'm an outdoorsy kind of person. Scuba diving appealed to me. The Everglades was right there. We've both been down there so long and been through so many hurricanes, and we've seen, you know, it's mostly anecdotal evidence, but I've sensed that the hurricanes are getting stronger lately. There seems like one storm after another is something that's unprecedented. And I just felt like if we waited a little bit too long, like say another 5 years, eventually with a storm like what's coming this week, it's going to finally sink into people's minds. Plus, there's other factors. The water table down the aquifer is getting affected by encroaching seawater as the seas rise. It's not even just the hurricanes. I kind of was thinking about it. I wanted to be ahead of the curve before people started realizing this was going on and before all the equity we had in our property and our home just vanished, because I feel like that's going to happen. I feel especially like after this storm, I think there's going to now be a mass exodus because this is on the heels of other storms. And I just feel like if you're a property owner down there and you're anywhere near the coast and you're counting on that equity to maybe retire one day, I think it's really in your best interest to think about moving north or somewhere inland.
And that's a lot of speculation. Was there any point you're saying this is really hitting our lives in a personal way, besides the risk of losing property value?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you see a storm coming and you're thinking, you know, do I need to take off my day of work to put up hurricane shutters? Do I need to, you know, stock up on supplies? Or is this hurricane going to miss us? It's just getting harder and harder to make predictions about what's going on.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize if you're not from a hurricane area, you just hear about these storms coming. There is so much prep that goes into when a storm is. You don't even have to get hit by the storm to be affected by it. You have to start planning a week ahead if you want to really truly be prepared for a potential bad storm. You have to go out and get on lines to get gas. You have to try to find water. There's so much work. And then when the storm misses you, you've lost an entire weekend planning for something that didn't even hit. So there's that whole factor, too. You don't even have to get hit by the storm to feel the effects of these things. And it's very stressful.
Yeah.
So why Michigan? You could have moved inland anywhere. You could have moved back to the Northeast inland a little bit. Why Michigan?
Well, the main reason is my sister lives here. She lives in Ann Arbor. And just coincidentally, I was kind of reading articles about climate change. And some of the articles I read pointed out, like you said earlier, the Great Lakes might be a place to, you know, a desired place to live in case climate change really took effect and the coast became a place you wouldn't want to live because there is that supply of fresh water. Their temperature may become a little bit milder. I mean, there is the flip side where I guess I hear that potentially climate change could cause more severe winters, and that will be
polar vortex.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot of strong data to show that there's some kind of shift of population to states such as Michigan as of yet. How many families, though, do you think are thinking like you, considering the future, the way the climate is working out, and are taking action like you two did?
I'm not sure. I was trying to convince all my friends down in Florida to come up and move here so we could all be together again, but nobody seems too interested in leaving Florida because of the winters that I've talked to.
I'm just wondering if the people you know are having the kind of discussions. Maybe they're not ready to pull the trigger yet and sell their property, but are they talking about these things in a real way in your community in Florida?
You know, like I said before, we wanted to be ahead of the curve because I feel like most people really aren't thinking about it. I think this storm is going to throw a shock into a lot of people, and I think a lot more people will start having those serious discussions. But talking to friends, some, you know, when I told them why we were leaving, you know, I was totally forthright with them, like, we're leaving because we see this place as somewhere where you don't want to live in 10 years. And a lot of them, you know, the wheels started spinning, and I could see them thinking about it. There were very few people. There were some people that were kind of climate denialists, very few. They were like, well, what are you, crazy?
Yeah.
This is not really happening. I'm like, all right.
You've mentioned that a couple of times, and, you know, that's become a very politicized issue. Admitting climate change is happening is one thing.
Indicating
that, whether it's human cost or not is something completely different. Do you know people who would think that you were foolish for making this move?
Well,
I know
a few, I
do too.
What do they say?
Well, they're climate deniers, basically. Our neighbors were like, you know, oh, it's just a cycle. It gets like this all the time. You just don't remember how bad it was before. Mm-hmm.
There's so many people who still deny that it's actually even happening. Like you said, you know, the data is clear that it is. It's really, the question is whether that's man-made. I think that's pretty much settled too. But, you know, if you want to believe 97% of the climate scientists. So a lot of the denial on that side, I think a lot of it, like you said, is very political and it's very ideologic. They start with that ideology and then lawyer their way to, well, you know, it's only 97% of the scientists. And I could show this one here that says, you know, they'll latch onto that. And that's just human psychology. So.
Yeah.
How do you feel about your move to Michigan? Are you happy so far?
Oh, yeah. I'm ecstatic. It's absolutely beautiful where we live. And the people are so much nicer.
Well, welcome to Michigan.
Thank you.
And prep for your winter. Buy extra clothing.
Yeah. I see they make heated clothing now, which they didn't have when I was in Maryland.
I've never used those. I just find that layers work
well. I will let
really
you know
well.
How it works because I am definitely getting some.
Thanks for coming in.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Technology on the farm is advancing all the time. GPS helps farmers plant more efficiently. Equipment communicates with computer data to determine where and when it's best to use chemicals and so on. The most recent tech starting to be used on farms is a drone. With the right sensors, drones can check on crop pests, check on soil moisture, and even look at plant growth in a more standardized way than a spot check by a farmer. Here to talk about how drones are used and might be used on the farm in the future is Robert Goodwin. He's a senior geospatial analyst at Michigan State University's Department of Geography, Environment, and Spatial Sciences. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
So drones have become popular for these overhead videos and still photos and even news coverage. How common is it for drones to be used in agriculture?
Drones in agriculture are becoming extremely common. Basically, drones have taken off in various places of agriculture, primarily cash crops right now.
And what do you mean by cash crops?
By cash crops, I mean corn, wheat, soybeans. But more often now, they're being used for other specialty crops. In Michigan, we are one of the most diverse states, agriculturally speaking. So we have things like grapes for wine and juice. We have peaches. We have all sorts of different fruits and all sorts of different agriculture, truck crops and whatnot that we can use drones for.
What's the most common way they're being used right now?
Most commonly for plant health, I would say. We have specialized sensors called multispectral sensors that allow us to look at the greenness or the health of certain plants. So that's the primary focus right now. Farmers will generate something called an NDVI, or Normalized Difference Vegetation Index, and that's sort of the standard way of looking at the differences of health in a field, whether that's from disease, whether it's from pest, fungus, whatever.
So what does it actually read? What data does it collect that actually helps the farmer determine the health of a plant?
So the cameras that we use, they record energy in different bands. Typically, the bands that are important are the red band and the near-infrared band. We can see in the red, you know, we can see visible light as humans, but we can't see out into the near-infrared. Fortunately, plants are reflective, highly reflective in the near-infrared. And the differences between the red light reflectance from a plant, which is consumed by chlorophyll, you know, red reflectance in a plant is very low in a healthy plant. So it's absorbing a lot of the red light. At the same time, it's reflecting a lot of the near-infrared light. And these differences, as chlorophyll decreases, red light reflectance will increase, yet near-infrared light reflectance will stay fairly high. And when we ratio those bands, we can determine small differences in plant health.
Let's talk about some of the limitations. I mean, it takes training to use a drone. There are limitations by the FAA as far as how they're used. And the technology still has some limits in the amount of weight a drone can handle and how long it can stay in the air. Let's start with the training. How common is it for farmers to get the training right now?
I think it's still relatively uncommon for farmers themselves to get the training. There's a lot of thought out there that it's my farm, I don't need the training, although it is the right path and the legal path. But there's a lot of crop service companies and a lot of vendors out there that are sort of filling in that gap to actually do the flying. I think it'll increasingly become more common for farmers to do it themselves. But you think of farms and the sizes of farms these days, and they would have to employ people full-time just to do flying in a lot of cases.
Yeah, how much of a financial incentive right now is there to buy yet another piece of equipment and hire someone?
Well, exactly. I mean, the return on especially cash crops is pretty low. And so farmers are looking at this as a cost per acre. And if that cost per acre gets too high, then it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to invest in it. But a lot of that depends on the capabilities of the aircraft. So right now, aircraft can only fly anywhere between, say, 15 and 40 minutes. If you're talking about a quadcopter or some other multi-rotor aircraft, they can fly longer if it's a fixed wing, but still not cover large, large areas like maybe a manned aircraft can.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the possibilities of these drones right now. Is the industry adjusting as the potential for greater use by more industry and agriculture is happening? Are they making adjustments to these planes, and what are their limitations in the technology right now?
Certainly. There's sort of parallel technological improvements occurring right now. Battery chemistry is a big one, and obviously that's more important than just for drones. Autonomous vehicles and that sort of thing, electric vehicles rather, are, you know, very dependent on battery chemistry. So as battery chemistry improves, that'll improve the efficiency and the endurance of our drones. fixed wing can be a problem because it's more difficult to take off and land, but there is a new technology that's sort of becoming more common, is vertical takeoff and landing planes, where a plane will stay in the air much longer than a rotorcraft because it has airfoils in it and it wants to fly. It can fly. Without the use of those, it can at least glide, so it's more efficient. But taking off and landing has always been sort of difficult. So we now have vertical takeoff and landing planes. It takes off vertically, transitions to horizontal flight, flies for a very long time, and then on its way back, it transitions back into a vertical landing and comes down automatically. So that plane can fly for anywhere from 30 to 40 minutes, which is usually a little bit longer than rotorcraft. More importantly, it can fly faster. So we're talking about, with a rotorcraft flying for 30 minutes at the maximum height allowed by the FAA, you might fly for 30 minutes and cover 80 acres. Whereas with this plane, you could cover 300 to 400 acres. And that's a game changer for especially cash crop farmers when you have fields that are a mile square or larger.
You mentioned the FAA restrictions that can limit the use of a drone. What are some of these restrictions? You mentioned altitude. What other restrictions are there? And are any of them being loosened anytime soon?
The altitude is actually the least important right now, in my opinion. The most important regulations that are sort of limiting are beyond visual line of sight and flying over people not involved in the operation and also flying over moving vehicles. Obviously, there's safety concerns with those, but if there's going to be large-scale agricultural acceptance of drones, using these beyond visual line of sight is important. And right now, you can apply for a waiver from the FAA to get that, but it's a bit of a process and you aren't guaranteed to get it. And if you're flying anywhere near urban areas or close by even small airports, it's likely you'll be denied.
Well, there's a big company who's wanting to change a lot of those rules. The farmers might be getting some help from somebody like Amazon or other delivery services.
Certainly. I was at a presentation at the GIS conference and there was a gentleman talking about just that. If he solves the problem for package delivery, because package delivery will require beyond visual line of sight, it'll solve the problem for everybody. So if the economics work there and they can convince the FAA that this loosening will help out that industry, then it'll only reap benefits for everyone else.
You're holding workshops to not only show farmers how to fly drones, but also to use data collection and geographic data analysis so that drones can actually do something useful beyond having an eye in the sky. How's that being received?
Pretty well. As far as I know, we're the only ones right now offering drone training where we actually not just teach the people how to fly the drone, because that's, to be perfectly honest, the easy part of the equation, but we're teaching people how to process the data and then even more importantly, analyze the data in geographic information systems so we can start creating reference data that goes back into things like precision agriculture. It's one thing to get up and fly a drone. It's an entirely another thing to derive useful information from that drone.
So we've talked about a lot of developments that might be coming. What do you think is the next big development that might be most helpful for farmers thinking about using drones to get some good information about their crops?
Right now, we're doing some research with some professors at Michigan State University in plant, soil, and microbial sciences, Addie Thompson, Eric Olson, Marty Chilvers, and some others that are looking at things like phenomics. And we're using LIDAR instruments, which are laser scanning techniques to build topographic surfaces and plant characteristics information, and also hyperspectral imagery, which is looking at not just a few bands of energy in reflectance, but looking at hundreds of different bands reflected in different areas along the spectrum. And that technology is very expensive right now, but as that matures a little bit more on the drone side, we'll be able to look very specifically at plants, say one plant from another, and say that's phosphorus limited or that is nitrogen limited or that's got a fungus. Right now, that's a little difficult with the broadband multispectral data that we're using right now.
I noted in an article you wrote that some farmers might get better benefit from it now than others. For example, row crop farmers might not find it as useful as, for instance, Christmas tree growers. Why would Christmas tree growers have a better advantage using drones?
Right now, what they want to know mostly in the Christmas tree community is where are their trees, how many trees they have, where they are, and how tall they are. And with drones right now, it's a fairly straightforward exercise along with some GIS processing to locate a georeference point for every tree, so that's your count, and then also extract the height And if they know the height, they know how many 7-footers they have, how many 8-footers they have. They can plan their harvests. They can do all sorts of things. Where back in the farming, it's a little more difficult to say, okay, if I fly over this cornfield and I see areas that are not as healthy as others, we're not exactly sure why that is. In most cases, you don't know exactly why that is. You actually have to go in the field and say, oh, okay, it's not healthy because there's a fungus, or it's not healthy because there's corn rootworm. It's not healthy because it's nitrogen limited. But you don't know that strictly from the imagery at this point. You have to sort of guess. Now, a farmer will know generally how their field is reacting, you know, what's going on in their field at any one time. But it's harder. It's a harder exercise. Whereas with Christmas trees, it's like, well, we're just doing counts and we're doing heights, and they can get a lot of benefit out of that.
Robert Goodwin is a senior geospatial analyst at RS&GIS, a research and outreach group within the Michigan State University Department of Geography, Environment, and Special Sciences. Thanks very much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Still to come, Traverse City might soon see cruise ship tours coming through its port. We're going to talk about the popularity of steamship travel on the Great Lakes before the popularity of the automobile changed tourism forever. You're listening to Stateside. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We recently reported that Traverse City is hoping to become a stop for Great Lakes cruise ships. There are a handful of cruise ship companies on the Great Lakes these days. It seems to be a growing trend and another piece of the puzzle in making the most of tourism in Michigan. But all of that got us to thinking of a time when steamships were not just for vacations, but a major mode of travel around the state. As you'll hear on this 1944 MGM film, Travel Talks, about travel by water to Mackinac Island.
It is a beautiful boat with a cruising speed of 15 knots, typical of the luxury liners that ply the Great Lakes during the summer season, transporting thousands of passengers to the many popular resorts for which the Great Lakes region is famous.
Joining us now is Bill Hurd. He's retired now, but he was the lead interpretive ranger and historian with Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
So why did we have a lot of passenger ships on the Great Lakes in the late 19th and early 20th centuries?
Well, the simple reason, it was the most convenient way to travel. Imagine, you know, before there were good roads for automobiles, or even before that with horses and wagon, if you wanted to get any place more than a few miles, a ship was the way to go. Especially if you had a lot of luggage to take along with you.
How typical was it for someone to travel by ship to get to a Great Lakes coastal community?
Well, it was the most common way for most folks. If you're down at the other end of Lake Michigan and you wanted to come north for a couple of weeks or a month, steamship was the most convenient way, and not only convenient, but also the most comfortable way to travel.
Give us an idea of what these ships look like. How big were they? Were all of them powered by steam, or did we have some sail ships before those steamships started?
They were steamships, started in around the 1860s when we started getting settlement of this area. There were, of course, a lot of sailing ships, schooners that carried smaller freight, but passengers were primarily on the steamships because they, with the steam, they could keep a fairly regular schedule from port to port, not having to depend on the wind so much. But they gradually increased in size and power. So by the turn of the century, you're looking at a ship that was about the 200 feet long, several decks. Fairly fancy, because almost a smaller version of something like you'd picture, like the Titanic, scaled down, two or three times.
I remember visiting Isle Royale several years ago, and we stopped on the way there near the island to look at a shipwreck. Superior is really clear there, and you could look down and see this big steamship that was there at one time. Were there a lot of wrecks like that, and how reliable was steam travel?
Well, you know, given the conditions that you didn't have reliable, sophisticated navigation, you didn't have a good weather reports, they probably did a pretty good reliability under and safety under their conditions. But yeah, there were tragic mishaps. There were steamships that capsized at the dock because of overloading. There were ones that caught fire and burned in the middle of the lake, some that just totally disappeared. But consider the number of trips and the number of people, they were fairly reliable transportation.
When we see steamships, whether it's paddle boats on the Mississippi or the Titanic in movies, seems like everybody's dressed to the hilt. They all seem to be wealthy or a little better, unless they're, you know, way down low on the passenger list. Mm-hmm. Who was the typical passenger on a steamship on the Great Lakes? Did you have to be wealthy, middle class? Were poor folks using it as well?
Yeah, all of those folks. Now, the ones that were probably coming for, a lot of families came to northern Michigan to spend 2 weeks or a month. And if dads couldn't get off work, they could actually get on a steamship in Chicago and Friday evening, sleep overnight, and arrive in Glen Haven at Saturday morning, spend Saturday and Sunday afternoon late to get back on the boat and be back in Chicago rested to go to work on Monday morning. That was $5 one way. So that was a little bit pricey, but, you know, for okay for upper middle class and a little bit of a luxury for just a weekend. So, the steamships were the most practical way of getting around. And so there were lower rates with lesser accommodations. And that's the way a lot of the, immigrants and settlers made it to northern Michigan and northern Wisconsin.
We've been talking about passengers, but I assume some of these ships were carrying goods to the different cities. How reliant were the cities on the Great Lakes on these ships?
Well, that was the main way to get things around in the early decades. But all the ships, even the ones that were primarily for carrying passengers, carried a lot of freight. The steamer trunks and everything for the passengers, but just a lot of just standard freight from port to port. But having a steamship, being a city that had a harbor, was important to the growth. And until the 1920s, when automobiles and trucks took over.
At Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore, there's a ghost town, Glen Haven, which was built because of steamboat traffic. How did that town first become established?
Well, it became established because there was a steamship company called the Northern Transportation Company that had a fleet of 24 ships. And at that time, the ships, the fuel was wood. And the ship needed to stop several times Chicago to Detroit. Would need to stop several times to get additional wood. It would burn so much wood, even if you didn't carry any cargo or passengers, you still, couldn't carry enough wood. So they picked the spot of Glen Haven because it had good protection from southwest wind and had town there, which would always have stacks of firewood ready to load its fleet of ships.
So what can you find or see at Glen Haven today?
Well, typically an early steamship town would have had a long dock going out into the water, and the remains of that dock are there underwater. It would have had a boarding house or a hotel, and the Sleeping Bear Inn is there for folks to see. There would have also, in a town like that, there would have been a general store to provide supplies to both the workmen and passengers on the ship, and the general store is there, and folks can actually go in and buy things. There's what have always been a blacksmith shop, and the blacksmith shop is there, so you can actually go in and watch the blacksmith work the iron and make small objects. Other than that, you just get the idea of what this area would have been like with in the early days, with lots of open space and trees, stacks of wood, piled up along the shore.
What do you think of this growing trend of Great Lakes cruise ships bringing tourists to different stops around Michigan and the other Great Lakes states?
Well, there's no doubt that cruising in the Great Lakes is spectacular, great scenery, so you know it's got to be a delightful experience. Always the question is when you come into a small port, you know, whether there are facilities there to handle the influx of people, but there's no doubt that it would be a really delightful experience sailing around on the Great Lakes.
Bill Hurd is a retired lead interpretive ranger and historian at Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore. Thanks for telling us about boats and ships in the Great Lakes.
Thank you for having me.
There's a steamer in the harbor with her engine shot with fire, and our hearts have gone aboard her for the Island of Desire. This time, our destination is Mackinac Island, and the good ship upon which we are about to sail is being guided out into Lake Michigan, just off the Chicago shore.
Labor Day marks the unofficial end of summer travel season in Michigan. Tourism has been up around the state in recent years, which got us wondering, how are things looking this year? Liz Ware is Vice President of Marketing at Mission Point Resort on Mackinac Island. She's a member of the family that owns and runs the resort. Hi there, how are you?
I'm fine, Lester. How are you today?
Just fine. So how has the summer season been going?
The summer season has been fantastic. We have had just a great season so far, a lot of very happy guests, and looking forward to more.
Well, how about the numbers? I mean, I don't need exact numbers, but what kind of percentages up or down have you seen this year?
We are probably up about 7% over last year.
Oh, that's pretty nice.
Yes.
So do you get a lot of Michiganders or Midwesterners, or where do your guests come from?
So about 70% of our guests come from the Michigan area, but we do get a lot of people from the surrounding states, and we're also seeing a lot of new traffic or a lot of new guests coming in from Texas, California, and New York. And we think Texas because it's so darn hot down there and it's so mild up here.
We've seen northern Michigan businesses struggle to find seasonal workers on the farm, for example. How has that been for you?
Well, if you look at the unemployment rate right now, it is the lowest that it's been. I think the hospitality industry in particular, throughout the United States, is really having challenges finding workers. We here on Mission Point have seen our fair share of that. It is more difficult to get people to come to a seasonal resort and work because we're open for 6 months and not a year.
Right. Mackinac Island, of course, brings in a lot of seasonal help from Jamaica, other Caribbean islands, from parts of Asia. But immigration rules have gotten a lot tougher under the Trump administration. How have those rule changes affected Mackinac Island, if at all?
Well, first of all, we do use workers from other countries. It's not immigration, though. We use a visa program. It's called the H-2B visa.
Right.
So our workers come. They come in for a period of time, 6 months, and then they go back to their homes. So they come, they work, they pay taxes, and then they return back to their countries and their families.
But even those visa restrictions, or the number anyway, have been tightened. Has it caused any problems?
They have been tightened. We are very hopeful that Congress will look closely at this matter this year. For every one H-2B visa worker that is here, it accounts for 5 American jobs. So without the help of our H-2B visa workers, you would find that in areas, particularly seasonal areas like ours, other industries would be affected. So your construction workers, your accountants, your architectural firms, your food service companies, all of those companies that support the hospitality industry would be impacted as well.
As the tourism season winds down, I wonder how Mission Point Resort and the other facilities on Mackinac Island kind of wind down for the season. What do you do to prep for leaving?
Well, we have a staff here of 45 throughout the year, so we don't necessarily wind down. Our off-season consists of a lot of construction and maintenance, but for the end of the season for our guests, it is really a fantastic time to be up on the island. It does slow down a little bit. Families with children are back at school, and so we see a different guest demographic coming up to the island. It is more quiet. It is absolutely beautiful. The flowers are still blooming. We get the colors of the leaves, and so we really have a good time with our fall guests.
I want to ask you a personal question. What do you do for vacation?
What do I do for vacation? Well, I haven't had one in a while. But
That's not good.
No, well, I live on Mackinac Island. Every day is a good day when you're on Mackinac Island.
That's what I'm told. In fact, somebody from the National Park Service was, or actually from the DNR, was telling me that very same thing. So, I mean, so you've got to have some downtime, though. If you're going to be at the island, what do you do for fun and for downtime?
Oh, so being on the island is great. One of the best things about the island that I think is one of the biggest secrets is that 80% of the island is a state park. So after work, we go out, go through the trails in the inner part of the island, and a lot of times people just spend time downtown. The interior of the island is absolutely beautiful, and so being able to go hiking, biking, or even horseback riding in the middle of the island is one of my very favorite things to do. And then we have, of course, some of our geological treasures like Arch Rock, and you can never tire of going to Arch Rock and looking out over the beautiful water of Lake Huron.
Liz Ware is Vice President of Marketing at Mission Point Resort on Mackinac Island. Well, enjoy your fall.
Thank you so much. We hope to see you back up here soon.
Okay.
Somehow the past and present seem to mingle together on this quaint island. On this romantic isle, at least, it seems that God's in his heaven and all's right with the world. And it is with this thought that we say farewell to Mackinac Island, pride of the Great Lakes.
Caitlin Horrock's latest novel, titled The Vexations, reimagines the life of composer Eric Satie. Horrocks lives with her family in Grand Rapids. Her fiction has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and The Paris Review. Stateside's Keith Taylor has this review.
Many of us have a vague impression of Erik Satie's music, moody movie music that plays behind sad or sometimes slowly passionate scenes in European films. There are any number of melodies we know, say his Gymnopédie No. 1, but some of us would be startled to learn that they were written by Satie. This seems to be music that is just out there in the world, existing all on its own, timeless, authorless. After reading Caitlin Horrock's new historical novel, The Vexations, based on Satie's wildly eccentric life, I have the distinct impression that this is the way the composer wanted his music to be remembered. Satie made what living he could playing piano with cabaret acts in the Montmartre district of Paris during the last of the 19th century and the first years of the 20th century. Yes, this is the world of the late Impressionists and the young Picasso. It is the world that invented surrealism, a term coined to critique an opera Satie wrote. It is the world of Proust, although Satie was several rungs down the socio-economic ladder. It is a world we've mythologized, and Horrocks, a professor of creative writing at Grand Valley State University, is brilliant at bringing us into this world, this myth, from a different angle. The Vexations, the title itself, might refer to an impossible piece comprising a simple line of music repeated 840 times over at least 10 hours, a piece the composer himself never expected anyone to ever perform. Although the last few decades have proven him wrong, you can find recent performances on YouTube. But really, in Horrocks' novel, the vexations are those other people. Satie's long-suffering family, particularly his brother and sister, who share center stage of this novel, friends like Debussy and Cocteau, the painter Suzanne Valadon, the only lover he ever had, and a host of others inhabiting what was then the underbelly of Paris. The people who Satie loved but couldn't understand, those who definitely didn't understand him or the conditions of his genius. There might be someone out there who will criticize Caitlin Horrocks for the dialogue, family dynamic, and plot lines she has invented for these lives. But don't listen to them. She has used her fiction to bring this fascinating and supremely odd composer to life and to remind us of those songs that, in her words, become so ubiquitous they are nearly white noise. But then they catch your ear and are beautiful all over again. They are wallpaper that can make you cry.
That's Stateside for today. I'm Lester Graham. Have a great Labor Day weekend.